My name is Eric. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Eric.
I'm nervous because I don't like telling the truth, but I'm glad to be here. I also have a built-in forgetter. When I got here, I really believed I was hopeless, and I found out that I was wrong. And it wasn't until I reread the book very recently. In the very beginning, it says, forward to the first edition. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. And I'm grateful for that today, because today I'm not hopeless. My sobriety date is March 20th, 2008. My home group is called The Vision for You. We're in Charlottesville, Virginia. We meet Wednesday nights at the Salvation Army and Saturdays at Hinton Avenue Methodist Church. I have a man in my life who has helped me every day and saved my life, and he's here tonight. And I have other men in my life today who are helping me and letting me help them. I'm surrounded by friends in the program. I've worked the first 9 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to the best of my ability and continue to work steps 10, 11, and 12 every day. I have an apartment today. The rent's paid. I have an unbelievable woman who is the love of my life. I have the addresses of all my family members in a book, and they're glad to get letters from me today. And when people wave today, they use all their fingers. I've been asked to share my experience, strength, and hope with everybody. I hope you hear something that will help you today. I know when I got here, it was really hard to get traction. And it was certain people, certain tone of voice, certain things they said and they did that managed to help me stay here today. Family stories tell me that alcoholism runs in my family quite a few generations back. My great-grandfather was a pioneer in western Nebraska, and he built a sod house out of dirt, and that's where he raised my grandfather, who was also a heavy drinker. When he was 80 years old, he would down 2 or 3 shots of peppermint schnapps, make some fried potatoes, and head off to the saloon, where he would often get in bar fights in his 80s. My dad grew up in that home and vowed he would always keep a job, and he did. And he was a very successful man, a very loving man, but was also alcoholic. And I grew up in a home where there was a lot of drinking, a lot of fighting, a lot of confusing behavior, and a lot of moves. Just when things would get good, we would decide to make a move, and usually it was across the country. As a very, very young child, I seemed to have a confusing ability to be right in the middle of the action, but want to hide at the same time. And as a kid, I did a lot of hiding. I would hide in my room. I would hide in the woods. And I started running as a kid, but I never ran too far when I was a child. I was very self-obsessed. I remember being just plagued with that as a kid. I couldn't stand people looking at me. If I thought people were looking at me or talking about me, I was really concerned about what they might be thinking or saying about me. And I would go to great pains to sort of be an anonymous type person and stay in the background. I was very concerned with etiquette. I never wanted to say or do anything that would hurt someone else. I seemed to be able to pick up other people's feelings to an extraordinary magnitude. And it seemed to me that I could feel what you were feeling. And I felt almost empathic that way. And I was very, very, very over-obsessed with how what I did made you feel. And so I went to great pains to hide my feelings all the time. And I hid behind food as a kid. I hid behind my intellect in many cases. I was a pretty good student in school. I did a lot of reading, I did a lot of drawing, I played music, anything that really kept me isolated. I also had a side that's pretty jovial and charismatic, and people would pick that up and try to engage with me, and I would start on a journey with somebody, but I would cut it off. As soon as somebody got too close to me, I would cut it off somehow.
And many times that was conveniently given to me because we would move or change schools and things like that. So I had an amazing pattern of dipping quickly into relationships and getting out really quickly as a kid. I went through high school pretty successfully, and I didn't drink. I managed to take care of myself pretty well until I was about 16 or 17. My parents experienced many trips to places that I wasn't proud to go to and afraid to go to, and they stayed together on and off until I finished high school. But when I went away to college, something happened. And I know today that it's untreated alcoholism that I was feeling. It was an incredible amount of inside, internal churning and anxiety and fear. And I had attacks. I remember going to a movie theater a lot of times and I couldn't sit through the movie. I felt like I was having an appendicitis attack. If I got to know somebody, particularly girls I liked, just an incredible amount of fear getting close to them. I was very concerned about how I looked, how I sounded, what I was doing, what I was not doing, just an overwhelming self-obsession. And I started seeing shrinks. I went to the college mental health clinic and said, something's wrong. And I started to get light diagnoses. They said I had colitis. They said you have depression. Different things like that. And at that point, I really was so freaked out that I couldn't finish school for the semester. So I went home my first year, and I started working at home. And nothing really seemed to change. I was still, it didn't seem to matter where I was, there I was again. And my drive to succeed was still pretty strong. So I came back to college. And one day, I was heading around one of the fraternities, and I walked up on a porch. And I thought back as a kid how I felt about alcohol. And there were many, many nights when I had gone into the garage where my father kept his liquor bottles. And I had taken them and smashed them against the wall. I had seen where alcohol took my dad and my mother. I saw the crying. I saw the pain. I saw the disappointment of people not showing up. I saw the fear that I had experienced. But somehow, some way, the alcohol called my name that night. And I remember walking up, I was in the back porch of the fraternity, there was a keg there. And somebody handed me a 16-ounce plastic cup of beer. And I drank it. And something happened. Up until recovery, it was no doubt in my mind it was the best day of my life. All those things, all those feelings that I hated and that I could not explain or justify went away. And I felt okay. Not just okay, I felt great. And that night I must have had 20 drinks. And that's when I knew what alcohol did for my dad. And it did the same thing for me. That first drink took me on almost a 25-year roller coaster ride. I finally finished school. It took me about 10 years. And one of the things that I remembered fondly about my family was both my parents loved to go to restaurants. And when we went to restaurants, everything was great. My dad was really well-behaved. Everybody was dressed up. My mom was happy, laughing. The waiters seemed to be on our side. And I loved the food. And I really decided at one point I wanted to own a restaurant. So I started doing a little bit of research. I started working in bars and restaurants and cooking. And I just loved it. I fell for it hook, line, and sinker. I loved the action in the restaurant. The hot, steamy saute pans. The guys in the back screaming, the crazy, wonderful women running around, the constant influx of customers, and the constant crisis and drama. It was just like growing up. And I really decided that, you know, this is for me. This is great. I also loved the fact that you could work whenever you wanted to. If you wanted to work mornings, you could. If you worked at night, you could. And what a great way to work and drink. And then at the end of the night, as a waiter bartender, you have this big, nice stash of cash. And if you're lucky, there might be a few bags of outside issues in there somewhere to get you through the night. One night, near the end of my college career, I had a few beers, and I used to read Craig Claiborne, who was a food critic for the New York Times. And I could be pretty aggressive when I wanted something. So I picked up the phone, and I called New York, the New York 411, and I said, can I have Craig Claiborne's number? And they gave it to me. So I get this guy on the phone, and we started talking. And I know now that he was on the other end doing what I was doing. He was drinking. So we had about a two-hour conversation. And I said to him, you know, I want to go in the restaurant business. What should I do? And he said, well, if you want to be a chef, you should go to the Culinary Institute, which is in Hyde Park, New York. And I said, okay, great, that's what I'll do. And I hung up. So that's what I did. I applied to the school. They put me on a waiting list because they have a big influx of people every year. And so what I decided to do was move to New York City and start working in some restaurants, and then I'd go to cooking school. So when I was finished with my degree, I finally graduated. Family was relatively happy for me and thought I was doing pretty well. And they said, what are you going to do now? And I said, beats me. And I really didn't know. So, like any good alcoholic, I packed my car. I took all the change that was in all the ashtrays in the house. And I had two changes of clothes. Filled the car with gas and left. And drove to New York City. No place to live, no job, nobody, no friends, nothing. But that's where I wanted to be. So I moved there. So I ended up hooking up with an old friend in Brooklyn. He let me crash in his house for exactly 2 weeks. And after that many days of being out all night, ringing the buzzer at 4 a.m. and waking him up, he said, you got to go. So I packed the car again, and I went over to Princeton, New Jersey, where I had another friend. And he let me stay there for a few weeks. Well, then I got pretty desperate because I needed a job. So I went into the city one night, and I'm walking down the village, pretty trash, and I see this restaurant. And this beautiful girl is outside hostessing, and she's rushing people in and out. And I walked up to her, and I said, are you hiring? And she said, well, not at the moment. We're too busy. I said, well, you need some help. Let me help you. So I grabbed some menus, and I took a pad, and I started waiting tables. And she hired me on the spot. She said, go ahead. Punch in the register and get your number and start going. So I had my first job in New York City. It was a jazz club down in the village, a great place. The problem was I was homeless. So what I did is I took my car over to Brooklyn, tried to find a relatively safe neighborhood, took the train back in to work. And what I did is I was volunteered to be the last guy to clean up. And when everybody else locked the door, I'd go upstairs and sleep and make sure I got out early in the morning because you could exit but not come back in. So I lived in the restaurant for 2 or 3 weeks. And finally, I accumulated enough cash, and I looked in the paper, and I found a sublet. So I took the sublet, and I was off to the races. I was a real New Yorker. I'd made it. I had an apartment, a studio, a job, cash coming in. It was great. And the best thing about New York was nobody could see me. No one knew what I was doing. I could drink all night long. Nobody cared. And I did. I drank every night, all night long, as much as I could get. And everything else you could imagine that goes with it. Before I left school, I had met a girl who I was convinced would be my wife. Her name was Beth. And she was from Charlottesville, where I had gone to school. And Beth and I were very close, and we partied a lot together. But Beth is not an alcoholic. And when I went to New York, Beth went to Pittsburgh to study costume design. And our dream was to one day open a dinner theater. Her family loved me, and I loved them. But by that time, my alcoholism had progressed to such a degree that I really didn't didn't know, I wouldn't even know how to describe my feelings for her, other than I had made a commitment to be with her in the future. But of course, that didn't have much standing on a day-to-day basis. But she came to New York one time to visit me, and she showed up at my apartment. I lived on the 5th floor, and it was a Friday night, and she walked upstairs, and I was drunk. And she said to me, "What's it going to be, alcohol or me?" And I think for the first time in my life, I really told the truth. I said, "Alcohol." And she said, "Okay." And she packed her bags, and she left. Years and years and years went by. I lived with that, with the guilt of that. And I had hurt Beth so many times, not shown up, lied to her, borrowed money I never paid back. But I was so drunk at that time that I really didn't care. And my disease has really only just begun. By that time, I was busy with a lot of other outside issues as well. My addictions had multiplied. And one night, I was down 23rd Street, and I got hooked up with someone who had what I wanted, and it was an outside issue. But I'd been drinking probably 3 or 4 days straight. And I remember I was standing on a railing looking down 2 or 3 stories. It must have been 3 or 4 in the morning. And through a series of events, I'd become paranoid. And I wanted to jump. And I did. And when I jumped down, I landed on my right heel bone. I crushed it into 5 pieces. And I was really freaked out. I was in the middle of New York City, 3 in the morning. Broken heel. But you know, I'm the kind of guy who, if I'm hanging on a cliff, like the Grand Canyon, by my pinky, and there's a mile down there, and if you lean over and say, "How you doing?" I'm going to say, "I got it. That's me." I got it. So I stood back up, and I said, I can walk out of here. And when I stood back up and put pressure down, I dislocated my ankle from my foot and collapsed. Not long after, I was trying to scream and hail down a cab and this and that, and finally a cab got me and took me to St. Vincent's Hospital, where I was immediately put into traction and had to go through a series of operations, not just one. Wonderful doctors. What they did was a miracle, because when they first saw it, they said, "You'll never walk again." And I'm walking today. But the most miraculous thing is that I was in traction for 3 weeks, and I then spent 3 months recovering from this accident with my foot up on a bed. I had lost my job, my apartment, my girlfriend, my fiancé. We weren't technically engaged, but everything you could imagine. And the day I walked out of my house, I drank again. Didn't even faze me. By this time, I really had very little direction left. I still wanted to cook. And I had an amazing ability to sort of fall up with jobs. I would lose a job, and then I'd get a better one. And it may have just been the level of bullshit I was able to pull out. But I kept getting better restaurant jobs, and they'd offer me more money. And at one time, I ended up in the Outer Banks, and my dad lived on the Outer Banks. And I worked in a hotel for a long time, and I loved that job a lot. But by this time, my drinking had escalated to such a degree that I could not even make it home at night. I would stay out for weeks at a time. At one time, I also checked in and out of motel rooms and all kinds of crazy stuff. One night I came to work, or one day I came to work, and my boss said, "I need to see you for a second." And this was in July. And he said, "I noticed that you checked into 5 rooms last night. In the middle of July, these rooms go for $250. I said, what were you doing? Well, I couldn't even remember. I had apparently gone in and out so many times and rechecked in when I came in. And that cost this guy a lot of money and a lot of wasted time. I know today that I was a blackout drinker, and then I experienced periods where I was semi-conscious, but I just kept on rolling anyway. On Sundays, I would usually come down for a little brief period of dry sobriety. I would get really hungry. And there was a Chinese restaurant where I used to go in. They had a buffet. What I didn't realize is that the guy who owned the restaurant used to see me when I was doing some outside issues. I would be dumpster diving, looking for a tin can and some ashes. And he would see me doing my thing behind the dumpster. You know, I thought I was slick. But I went in on Sunday night to get the buffet, and I would go up to this buffet, and I'd start eating. I would eat for 2 or 3 hours at a time. And one night, this guy comes over the table, and he says, "You eat too much. You eat 4 pan lo mein. You eat 4 pan, you pay for one. You eat for 4, you pay for one. And I see you last night, behind the dumpster. Your eyes are bugger out." He said, "You go so many times back and forth. Why do you do that? You need help." But somehow, I kept on going. I kept on going. My business partner, friends and family, tried to do an intervention on me one night. And I had so many enablers in the restaurant business, I got calls telling me about this intervention. So what I did is, I called a friend of mine who had a Jeep. And we got in the Jeep and we started drinking and other things. And we headed up to Currituck County, which is north of the Outer Banks. And there's a lot of sand and dirt up there. I don't know if you've been to that area. But I'll never forget this. My business partner and best friend at the time somehow located me. And he had a Jeep also, so his Jeep was right behind mine. And we were headed up 158, going at least 70 miles an hour. And he was trying to catch me. And I headed off into the sand. And there was this, you know, stream of sand coming out like smoke behind us. And we started making this circle. It was like a Starsky and Hutch routine in this circle. And my friend was behind us and just kept chasing us and chasing us. And all I wanted to do was have one last drink. I knew it was going to be over. But I did not want to give up that drink. And eventually, you know, he caught up to us and I got out of the Jeep. And I surrendered to him. But I did not surrender in any other sense. And I said, okay, I'll go to rehab. So I went to rehab. And I was there for 28 days. And they told me that I was the most surrendered person in the group. And I'll never forget that. They told me I was surrendered. And I was pretty good. You know, I did all the writing. I ate all the bean sprouts. I tasted all the honey mustard. And, you know, I did the yoga and I did all that kind of stuff. And when I was getting ready to get out of rehab, I remember being so terrified because I knew I was going to drink again. I knew it. I didn't know when for sure, but I knew I was going to drink again. I didn't want to leave rehab. That was the first time in my life I'd actually felt relatively safe for myself. When I got back home, I found out that my best friend's sister had committed suicide while I was in rehab. And he and I jointly owned a restaurant on the Outer Banks. So he had to go back and deal with that with his family in Ohio. And I was left with a restaurant that I was in no shape to run at all. By this time, too, my father had Parkinson's disease and it had progressed quite a bit. And his wife had passed away also that year. So here was Dad and I in the Outer Banks trying to help each other stay sober and relatively sane. And both of us drinking. Me trying to run a restaurant, and him struggling with Parkinson's. And I really hate even thinking about that time because it was an impossible situation. And at one point, I just gave in. You know, that day came when I just drank again. And off to the races I went. For some reason, I made a phone call at one point, and I called back to the rehab I went to, and I said, you know, I don't think this is going to work. I need something else. So they said, okay, we have a halfway house in West Palm Beach. And I thought, West Palm Beach. Okay, I can go there. So I went to West Palm Beach, and that started a journey. I think I counted correctly, 17 different halfway houses in 2 years. In and out, in and out. Swearing I wasn't going to drink, you know. Getting a job, following the rules. I had all the meetings, matrix on the clipboard, and I'd sign them all perfectly. And I'd cook for everybody, and I'd clean up, and I would fold the laundry. You know, everything they asked me to do. But there was something inside of me that I could not seem to share with anybody or explain. And it was that I could not drink. It was awful. I got a lot of jobs down there, obviously, and recently I went back to make amends and try to find some of these people, and it was quite a journey. I ended up moving south as I went, further away, you know, cheaper areas so I could get less and less, you know, responsibility. And at one point, I remember living in a hotel, and they asked me, how are you going to pay the rent? And I didn't have any money, so I just let it ride a day. And this is typical in my life. Something always seemed to happen. And I hadn't spoken to my family in probably 3 or 4 months. They probably thought I was dead. But somehow, I got a message that my dad wanted me to call him. I think it came from one of the halfway houses I'd stayed in. One of the friends managed to find me. So I called my dad, and he said, you know, there's a guy here at a country club who wants you to come back and cook there. Why don't you give him a call? And this was in the Outer Banks again. So I called up there. The guy was going to pay me more money than I had ever made in my life. Now, I'm sitting here in West Palm Beach. There's a payphone outside. No shoes on. You know, I was buying clothes at the Salvation Army. I was eating food out of the food bank. I was basically moving from hotel to hotel, doing whatever I could to stay afloat. And here's a payphone, and I have, you know, just enough change to make the call. And I'm negotiating with this guy about benefits for a full-time job on the telephone. And he bought it. He bought it. And then he said, well, how can we get you here quickly? And I thought, well, if I ask for a Learjet, I might be pushing it. So I said, well, how about I'll take the train? Can you send me a train ticket? And he said, okay. So I took the train ticket, and I came back up to the Outer Banks. I started working again as a chef in a busy country club. Lobster, caviar, champagne, all that stuff again. And here I was living basically like a homeless person. If you open my refrigerator, you'd find a box of baking soda, a banana peel, and maybe 4 or 5 types of mustard. I had no cash. I was making tons of money, but it was gone by the time 11 p.m. at night. Every penny was gone. And I started running again, just running. I mean, as soon as I could get out of work, I would. I would go run and do what I needed to do just to get through the night. By this time, my dad had progressed in his illness a lot, and he was in a very critical situation. And he and I talked about every day at some point for a while, but there came the time when I got disconnected again. I was the king of the disappearing act. And one day, I was out in the car roaming around, looking for something. And a friend of a friend rolled up next to me and said, I need to talk to you. And she said, your dad collapsed last night, and they flew him to Charlottesville. And something happened to me. Out of all the crazy, irresponsible, downright stupid, and cruel things that I had ever done, that really hit me. Because there was no excuse for that. You know, my dad was in no shape to help himself at all. And I was scared. I was scared of what was going to happen. I drove back up to the country club, and I found one of the guys I worked with, and I asked to borrow some money. And he gave me enough money to get to Charlottesville. I filled my gas tank. I packed the clothes I had. And I drove to Charlottesville. And at that point, I had missed work probably 3 or 4 weeks in a row. They were out hunting for me and had pretty much given up on me. My landlord had done the same thing. And by the time I got to Charlottesville, I was jobless, homeless, friendless, and what I didn't realize, soon to be familyless. Because when I pulled into Charlottesville, my sister had had it. She lived in Pennsylvania at the time, and she had to come down. She called my uncle, who lives in Colorado, and he flew in. And one of my aunts, who lives in California, flew in. And when I walked into the UVA hospital, there they were. And two things hit me, you know, when I think back. One is, what a schmuck, you know, what a jerk I was. But the second thing was, this is not supposed to be about me. And yet it was. And I know today that that's a big part of alcoholism for me. Everything's about me. If I go visit someone in the hospital and they're sick, I'll say, why is this happening to me? And that was a very, very painful time. My sister wouldn't speak to me, and basically they had put a barricade. I wasn't allowed to see my father. Now, I was penniless. I had no money, nowhere to live, no job. My old behavior kicked in right away. I thought, I gotta get a job. I was using the fax machine at the hospital to send my resume out. I was eating in the hospital cafeteria because I could sweet talk about anybody who works in the kitchen. I parked my car in the garage of the hospital and slept there during the day. And at night I'd walk in to be with my dad. And during that time, I wasn't drinking. And I was really scared. And all those old feelings came up. The anxiety, the panic, the depression. It was just awful. And I hadn't lived in Charlottesville in a while, so I really didn't know anybody. But little by little, I found people. And I got alcohol back in my system. And I was okay. A few drinks and I was okay again. My dad got worse at one point, and we really thought it was going to be the end. So they took him up to New Jersey or Pennsylvania, where my sister lives, and put him in a nursing home. And then I was left alone in Charlottesville. My family didn't want anything to do with me. So couldn't go back to the Outer Banks, living in the car. Got a job at Boar's Head. Another jump up. Started working at Boar's Head, 90 hours a week, lots of money, and I was back in business. Got an apartment. But this time, none of that stuff worked. This was the time it didn't work anymore. I couldn't even get through the day at work. Nothing excited me at work. I was terrified of the future, terrified of the past. And I hated living in the moment. I had been to AA before. And I had been to rehab and halfway houses. And I'd come sit in the back. And I'd feel a little bit better. You know, when I come in, I'd get a little coffee in my system, maybe a cookie. Find some pretty girl to look at. Guys would come talk to me. And I'd be okay for a little bit of time. But as soon as I felt better, I would check it back out again. That went on for quite some time. But this time, something else happened. When I went to the meeting, I didn't feel better after a while. I felt worse. And I couldn't figure that one out. I'd heard about the four-step, and I'd done a little bit of four-step work and treatment. And I did know, there's a lot of secrets that I have to talk about in the four-step. But there was a secret that I could not even describe. And that was that deep inside, I knew I did not know how to live without alcohol. I knew it. But I had no idea how to tell you guys that. I didn't hear it. I didn't hear you guys talk about that. I heard you guys talk about drinking, and I heard you guys talk about great life not drinking. But I didn't hear the in-between part. The part that happens to me when you take my drink away, and I'm left sitting with me. I didn't hear that part. And the reason is I didn't stick around long enough to hear it. As soon as I thought I felt better or had another opportunity to get better, I'd bolt. One day I was limping up the road. I still had problems with my leg. And when I'm drinking, of course, it gets worse because I stay up all night and walk in crazy places and all that, try to dance. But I was walking up a steep hill one day, and a guy who knew me from the meetings, who's always driving around trying to help people, rolled down his window. And he leaned out the window and he said, "Are you tired of beating yourself up?" And you know what? I was. He said, "Get in the car." And he started taking me on some trips out in the country for fresh air. He started making me laugh. I hadn't laughed in a long time. He started giving me apples. We'd go to Wendy's and have chili. And he started talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. And for some reason, I listened. I listened. He told me that I wasn't the only one who felt crazy when I wasn't drinking. He told me I was the only one, not the only one, who had crazy adventures when I was drinking. Really crazy. He told me I wasn't the only one who was sad. I had a lot of problems when I got here. I had job problems, family problems, clothing problems, hair problems, dental problems, financial problems, car problems. I had a lot of problems. And I liked talking about those. And this guy would listen. And he would say, "Let's go for a little ride." And we would ride over by the hospital. And he'd take a bite of his apple and he'd say, "Look up there." And the helicopter would come in called Pegasus. And Pegasus, as you may know, brings critical patients into UVA emergency room. And that helicopter would land and out would come the stretcher. And he wouldn't say anything, but I knew what the deal was. It wasn't me today, but it sure could have been. Going to the dentist is not the same as coming out of Pegasus on a stretcher. But I was so mixed up and crazy that I didn't know that. I was angry, hungry, lonely and tired when I got here. And you guys fed me. And you told me I don't have to drink today. And I don't have to be angry today. I'm not lonely today either. I do get tired on occasion. But it's a good kind of tired. I didn't know that what I had when I stopped drinking was untreated alcoholism. I thought it was a lot of other things. And I thought it was a product of a lot of other things. But it was a product of alcohol. And it would take time for me to get past the untreated alcoholism. And I had to treat it with something else than alcohol. My disease always seeks treatment, whether I like it or not. I started writing things down in the fourth step, and I learned how to be transparent to somebody, how to let somebody in. And I learned that, you know, if it has a name, someone else did it. I didn't know that. I shared secrets about documents showing records of the past, personal things, legal issues. This guy said, "Come on, we're going to take care of some stuff." So we started cleaning things up. He took me to court. He was there when I paid back bills. He was there when I needed to cry. I started with small stuff and gradually moved on to some bigger things. And I was able to do it pretty quickly with the help of somebody else. my dad got a little bit worse and looked like he wasn't going to make it. And one of the greatest gifts I've gotten in sobriety is that I got to see him before he died and I was sober. And the man who helped me insisted on it. I'm not sure I would have been able to do it on my own. He insisted on it. And thank God for that. He took me up there and I got to sit and hold my father's hand. Tell him goodbye. The things I've done to my mother were unspeakable. Unspeakable. And he knew that. And all he kept saying was, your mom's great, love her. And I talked to my mother every week. And I paid her back a lot of the money I owed her. I sent her cards. And I listen to her today. I don't talk at her anymore, I listen. My sister was younger than I was. I never really had a chance at the table. Because by the time the conversation baton got to me, it's time to go to bed. And I always knew that she resented that because I was very overbearing as a kid. And what I do today is I just sit and listen to her and I catch myself. When the conversation is about me, I catch myself and I say, shut up. Listen to her. Let her talk. I make amends to her on a regular basis because I love her dearly and I may have hurt her the most. I found out at one point that Beth, the famous Beth, had remarried. And I was kind of glad to hear that. And I know today that I'm grateful for that because I don't have to look back and at that particular person and deal with the wreckage. Thank God she had the sense to get away when she did. I found out she married a great guy. Her family saw me at a grocery store and said, why don't you get in touch with Beth? Now this is from a family who knew what I did. How is that possible? It's not me. I called Beth and I said, I'd like to see you next time you're in town. She came to town and this is how I've changed. In the past, my current girlfriend, his name is Kathy, would have been a second priority to me. I would have thought to myself, I'm trustworthy, so she should trust me. So there's no need to involve Kathy. This is between me and Beth, and she should trust me. That's not what I did. I know today that what I think and feel may not be accurate. So I told Kathy all about it. And I told Kathy exactly when I was going to meet with Beth and exactly when I was going to be done. And I made sure I saw Kathy right before and I met Kathy right after. Because that's how I would want to be treated. I have insecurity, and if it had been the other way around, my mind would have played big tricks on me. So I thought, what is the best thing I can do for Kathy? But don't get me wrong, I don't do this all the time. But I love Kathy. And when I went to meet with Beth, something happened, very powerful. I told her the truth. I told her I was alcoholic. I told her that, you know, I'm in recovery. And I said, I want to tell you that I know what I did. And I was wrong. And I gave her some validation about all those times, all those things that I had done. And then I did something that was recommended for me to do, which I really hate doing. I said, what else is there? What don't I know that I've done? And she told me a few things. And I remembered them when she told me. I had forgotten them, but I remembered them. I found out that she had just lost a baby. And that she was pregnant again. That she had a pretty happy marriage. And that was that. A week later, I got an email from Beth. And I said, thank you. I'm putting you on my email list and I want you to be a part of my life. The memories of Beth that I had obsessed about all those years, There was nobody like Beth. And I could never seem to find anyone like Beth until I met Kathy. And I know today that Kathy's the woman I love. And there was that closure. Beth was a woman of my past. And Kathy's the woman I love today. And there's no mess there for me. And I'm just so grateful for the way these steps help me get through these times, because I don't have to worry if I run into Beth or her parents, or, you know, what am I going to say? What am I going to do? I said it. And step 10 is really helpful today, because I can make messes really quickly. Really quickly. And if I don't have some sort of spot check in my life, I'm going to do it again. Now, I'm not a very regulated person in the program. I don't have a 10-step sheet at night. But what I do is I stay plugged in. I go to step meetings. I talk to people every day. I make notes during the day. If there's something I haven't attended to that I need to, I make a note about it. And at the end of the day, I somehow organize the next day so that I can get started on that and get that past me so I can get through the day. Because I can't sit with stuff very long. I tend to get tied up. And eventually I would drink again about anything. Step 11 is my favorite step, prayer and meditation. Prayer is what got me through. I had never prayed before I got here with any consistency or with any sincerity. I did go to church. At one point when I was in West Palm Beach, I was dipped, I was dunked, sprinkled, and splashed. And none of it stuck. But when I got here this last time, I was so desperate. All I could say was, God, please help me sleep sober today. And I still do that. At the end of the night, I do get down on my knees and I thank God. Thank you for keeping me sober. Now, during the day, I can somehow construct more sophisticated prayers. But they're nothing like those prayers. It's very simple for me. I can make things complicated. Meditation for me is really just as simple as listening. I'm not a yoga-type person or incense-type person, anything like that. But what I do is I listen. I listen to tapes, speakers. I listen intently to people at meetings. I get off by myself sometimes, and I'll sit quietly and just listen to whatever noise is being offered. And what that does is it quiets the noise in my head. It relieves me of the bondage of self. And it takes me to a place where I am teachable, where I can learn a new way of life. This program is not what I thought it was going to be. It's an open door. When I got here, I thought the doors were shut. And I really thought that AA was like a little tiny room. And you guys were going to put me in this little tiny room and shut the door. And I was safe as long as I was in that room. But there wasn't much else going on there. And I know today that it's the opposite. It's opening the door. It's an open door. Today, I am so glad to have my life back. I wouldn't drink. I don't want to miss a minute of my life. When I got here, I was really angry that I got my life back. I didn't like my life at all. And I know today that's because my life sucked. Because I had never treated it with anything but alcohol. And if it had ever said on the side of the Jack Daniels bottle, if you drink this, you will lose your girlfriend, your car, your job, your house. I might have thought twice, but I didn't say that. I'm the kind of guy that if you put alcohol in my system, I can be going down a highway speeding. I can have someone in the car threatening my life. But if I have alcohol, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that. If you take away the alcohol and you want me to go apply for a job or go to court with somebody or even go to church sometimes, I'm a wreck. I don't feel comfortable. I just don't feel comfortable. But today, what I know is that's alcoholism. It's alcoholism. Restless, irritable, and discontent. I treat the restless by keeping busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. Irritability. gratitude. When I get irritable, I think back of the first meeting I came to when I was desperate. I was desperate. And whoever was sitting there, I was so glad you were here. Now don't get me wrong, I could start judging. I could start getting irritable at meetings. But that's not the reality. My perception is messed up. I forget. Discontent. I never got what I wanted. And yet I always did. That's how crazy I am. I believe both of those are true. I never got what I wanted, and yet I always did. That's too big for me to even put my arms around. But it's true. So what I do today is I focus on what I need. And as my needs and wants converge, I become a much happier person. I know today that there's a hole inside me that alcohol filled beautifully for a long, long, long time. And when you took that alcohol out, I had high expectations and low behavior. And what I've learned to do in this program is two things. Lower my expectations and raise my behavior. My disease has two parts. I'm physically addicted. If I put alcohol in my system, I'm not going to stop. I am not going to stop. It's been proven to me thousands and thousands of times. I have no control whatsoever. I will be stopped only by the police, by an intervention, by passing out, by running out of money and booze. But I'll start again. But if you take away the alcohol, I have another disease. Untreated alcoholism. And that's the part I never got. I just couldn't get it because I didn't stay here long enough to get that. And this time I did. And I realized, you know what? That's the disease I can treat. That was the surprise. I always thought I could treat the physical part. I'll just drink a little less this time. I just won't drink whiskey. I'll drink by myself. I won't drink on Tuesday. I'll do something different and then drink. I can't beat that game. But I have found that in this program, I can live without the untreated alcoholism symptoms, which are depression, loneliness, fear, anxiety. Those go away. But I have to keep coming back. And I have to trust you guys. And I have to remember this is a we program. I heard something great the other day I just want to share. A lot of people, including me, had trouble with step two. And a woman raised her hand at a meeting and she said, "You don't have to worry about step two. If you keep coming back, you will be contacted." And that was my experience. Thanks for letting me share.